The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Amelia Gordon Memorial Lecture. My name is Rich Greenewalt, and I'm a member of the Library Foundation Board of Directors and a proud supporter of this great library. If you haven't explored the Free Library in a while, I encourage you to take the time to discover all we have to offer in addition to our wonderful author event series. Through mid-January, our rare books department is exhibiting their impressive collection of cuneiform tablets and other relics from the ancient Near East, some of which date back to 3100 BC. Learn more about this exhibition and our other hidden gems by going online at freelibrary.org. Now, before we begin, please take a moment and silence your cell phones. Please do that. Also, I'd like to remind you that following tonight's event, there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. Books are for sale from Joseph Fox Bookshop, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the Free Library. Salman Rushdie is a critically acclaimed, best-selling novelist known for his witty examinations of an ever-changing socio-political landscape. His many books include Booker Prize winner Midnight's Children and The Enchantress of Florence, which was named one of the best books of 2008 by the Washington Post. Professor Rushdie was inspired to write his new novel, Luca and the Fire of Life, for his young son. There is something very exhilarating about trying to please an individual reader, said Rushdie in a recent profile. Someone as special as your own child offers a different challenge. It's a challenge he has risen to quite well. The Guardian praises his novel as an engrossing and fantastic fable, and The Independent calls it marvelously original, with moments that are startlingly beautiful, both for the richness of the imagining and the crafting of the prose. We are honored to have such a literary icon here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Salman Rushdie.
Hello. Hello, nice to be back here. I think it's the fourth time, I think, so may as well just put a bed in the corner. I must say it's been wonderful to see how this book's getting received, because it's, of course, a book that you write for your own child is something very close to your heart, and it's only the second time in my life I've done it. He has advice for me, of course, my son Milan, who is now 13, and what he says is, Dad, stop writing novels, write series. And it's quite true that if you look at what his friends are reading, everything is sort of like volume 5 of 8, you know. And it's taken me 20 years to write volume 2. So that's not very commercial of me, but who knows, I might accelerate. And it reminded me also of a piece of advice I was given many years ago about writing for younger readers. When I was just starting out as a writer, I think actually it was even before Midnight's Children was published, just a few months before, I went to a literary party in London given by my publishers, Jonathan Cape, who were in those days sort of the best independent publishing. Now they're a company, now they're part of Random House. But anyway, they used to give this legendary Christmas party, which was only for writers. So you'd walk into this room and be kind of awestruck at who was there, because they had the best list, you know, of anyone. So there would be Doris Lessing in one corner and John Fowles in another corner and everybody else you can think of. And I was this young writer who nobody'd heard of, waiting for his novel to come out. And I was collared by my publisher's father. My publisher, Tom Mashler, was a famous British publisher. His father, Kurt Mashler, had also been a very eminent publisher in Germany, and then had had to flee the rise of Nazism, as so many German Jews did, and settled in London. And his son, I guess, took over the family business. Now, Kurt Mashler had published a lot of the most eminent highbrow, kind of egghead writers in Germany. But his real passion was children's books, which he also published quite a few of. And so he came and grabbed me, sort of like the Ancient Mariner, you know, kind of latched on. There was a ship, you know. And he said in his very heavy Germanic accent, he said, "You must a children's book write." You know? And at that point, my older son was barely a year and a half old. And so I said, you know, well, maybe when the boy grows up, I'll think of something to write for him. And he said, no. He said, "I will to you a story tell." And he told me a story about how one of his most eminent writers in Germany had been the German writer Erich Kästner, author of books on philosophy and this and that. And he would collar Kästner every so often in the same way and say, "You must a children's book write." You know? And eventually Kästner, so irritated by this harrying, went away for a few weeks and wrote a manuscript and brought it in and threw it down on his desk and said, "There you are, and now you can stop bullying me." And this book was a book called Emil and the Detectives, and it became one of the greatest classics of German children's literature. And as Kurt Mashler said to me with a certain degree of glee, he said, "It's the only book of his that's still in print." So he said, "You must say children's book, right?" So I remembered this advice. And I don't know, sometimes I think that maybe that'll happen. Maybe Harun and the Sea of Stories and this one, Luca and the Fire of Life, will end up being what's left of me. And I think that would be cool, actually. That would be fine. Because I've enjoyed writing these books. And I wanted just to start off by reading you, there's a little acrostic verse, which is the dedication of the book, which is five lines, in which each line is one of the letters of my son Milan's name. And it goes like this. "Magic lands lie all around, inside, outside, underground. Looking glass worlds still abound. All their tales this truth reveal. Naught but love makes magic real." And the reason I say that I wanted to read that is because it seems to me to contain the two major themes of the book. One is that I think it is a love story. I mean, I don't think it's not a romantic love story, see, but it's a story about the love between parents and children and between fathers and sons. Actually, there's a very important mother character in the book too, so mothers and sons as well. And how much children as well as parents will do, how far people will go in the name of that love. And this is a book in which a boy of 12 sets out to save his father's life. Clearly, that's a quest born out of love. So that's one of the themes of the book. And the other is this, to me, very sort of repeatedly interesting question of the relationship between the world of our imagination and the world in which we live. What is the connection between the world of dream and fancy and make-believe and what if and the actual physical world that we inhabit? And I've always thought that the connection is much more important than we think, that the world of fantasy, if you like, is not as separate as we think from the real world. Because for a start, I mean, if you even just look at invention, everything begins in dreams. You know, you have to imagine a wheel before you can make a wheel. You have to imagine a hyperlink before you can have the internet. Everything begins in fancy and then sometimes crosses that boundary into the real world. So it's a book about that, about a boy who has to go. He has to essentially do a number of impossible things to save his father's life. He knows that if he gets into this parallel reality, that in it there are various magical objects, one of which, the fire of life, might be able to save his father's life. But the trouble is, you know, you can't get in there. That's not possible. And if you get in there, you're supposed to steal the fire of life, which you can't do. And if you do steal it, you've got to get back, which is impossible too. So he has to do three impossible things before breakfast, as the saying goes. And so obviously that's what he sets out to do. I wanted to read you a bit, because the thing about magic worlds, if they're going to be at all credible, is that they have to have geography. And they have to have history too. And I suppose they have to have biology, but probably not in a children's book. This is just a little bit about the geography of the world of magic, as told to Luca by his storyteller father. The torrent of words, by the way, thunders down from the sea of stories into the lake of wisdom, whose waters are illumined by the dawn of days, and out of which flows the river of time. The lake of wisdom, as is well known, stands in the shadow of the mountain of knowledge at whose summit burns the fire of life. This important information regarding the layout and, in fact, the very existence of the magical world was kept hidden for thousands of years, guarded by mysterious, cloaked spoilsports who called themselves the Ilim, or learned ones. However, the secret was out now. It had been made available to the general public by Rashid Khalifa in many celebrated tales. So everyone in Kahani was fully aware that there was a world of magic existing in parallel with our own non-magic one. And from that reality came white magic, black magic, dreams, nightmares, stories, lies, dragons, fairies, blue-bearded genies, mechanical mind-reading birds, buried treasure, music, fiction, hope, fear, the gift of eternal life, the angel of death, the angel of love, interruptions, jokes, good ideas, rotten ideas, happy endings, and in fact, almost everything of any interest at all. The Alim, whose idea of knowledge was that it belonged to them and was too precious to be shared with anyone else, probably hated Rashid Khalifa for letting the cat out of the bag. But it is not yet time to speak, as we will eventually have to speak, of cats. I'm not going to tell you about that. Luca does manage somehow to stumble over into the magic world. And one of the first things he finds there is something very alarming. He finds a figure of a man standing in the lane outside his house, which looks exactly like his father, who is at this point has fallen into a coma and his life is slipping away. So it's rather surprising to see him standing in the lane outside the house. But this figure that looks exactly like his father, as he rapidly discovers, is not his father. This Rashid Khalifa. I should point out that Luca has two companions. More companions, they're animals, but they're more companions than pets. He has a dog called Bear, and he has a bear called Dog. So every time he says bear, you know, the dog comes. When he says dog, the bear comes. They're escaped circus animals, and they become his friends. So they're with him too. This Rashid Khalifa looked exactly like the famous Shah of Blah. He was wearing his Panama hat and his vermilion bush shirt, and when he walked and talked, it became obvious that his voice was Rashid's voice, and the way he moved was an exact copy of the original two. But this Rashid Khalifa could be seen through, not clearly, but murkily, as if he were half real and half a trick of the light. As the first whispers of dawn murmured in the sky above, the figure's transparency became even more obvious. Luca's head began to spin. Had something happened to his father? Was this see-through father are you some sort of ghost? He asked in a weak voice. You are certainly something peculiar and surprising, to say the very least. Am I wearing a white sheet? Am I clanking chains? Do I look ghoulish to you? Demanded the phantom dismissively. Am I scary? Okay, don't answer that. The truth is that there are no such things as ghosts or specters, and therefore I am not one. And may I point out that right now I'm just as surprised as you. Bear's hair was standing on end. That's the dog. And Dog was shaking his head in a puzzled way. that's the bear, as if he had just begun to remember something. "Why are you so surprised?" Luca asked, trying to sound confident. "You're not the one who can see through me, after all." The see-through Rashid Khalifa came closer, and Luca had to force himself not to run away. "I'm not here for you," he said. "So it's unusual for you to have crossed over when you're in perfect health. And your dog and bear, too, by the by. The whole thing is exceedingly irregular. The frontier is not supposed to be this easily ignored." "What do you mean?" Luca demanded. What frontier? Who are you here for?" The moment he asked the last question, he knew the answer, and it drove the other questions out of his mind. "Oh," he said. "Oh. Then is my father..." "Not yet," said the see-through Rashid. "But I'm the patient type." "Go away," Luca said. "You're not wanted around here, Mr. What is your name, anyway?" The see-through Rashid smiled a friendly smile that somehow was not entirely friendly. "I," he began to explain in a kindly voice that somehow did not feel completely kind, "I am your father's dad." "Don't say that word," Luca shouted. "The point I'm trying to make, if I may be allowed to continue," the phantom insisted, "is that everyone's dead." "Don't say it," Luca yelled. "Is different," the phantom said. "No two are alike. Each living being is an individual, unlike all others. Their lives have unique and personal beginnings, personal and unique middles, and consequently at the end, it follows that everyone has their own unique and personal dead." "Don't," screamed Luca. "And I am your father's. Or I will be soon enough. And at that time, you will no longer be able to see through me, because then I will be the real thing, and he, I'm sorry to say, will no longer be at all." "Nobody's going to take my father away," Luca cried. "Not even you, Mr. Whatever your name is, with your scary tales." "Nobody," said the see-through Rashid. "Yes, you can call me that. That's who I am. Nobody is going to take your father away." "That is exactly right, and I am the nobody in question. I am your, you might say, nobo-daddy." "That's nonsense," said Luca. "No, no," the see-through Rashid corrected him. "I'm afraid that nonsense is not involved. You will discover that I am a no-nonsense kind of guy." Luca sat down on the front step of the house and put his head in his hands. Nobo daddy, he understood what the see-through Rashid was telling him. As his father faded away, the phantom Rashid would grow stronger, and in the end there would be only this nobo daddy and no father at all. But he was very sure of one thing. He was not ready to do without a father. He would never be ready for that. The certainty of this knowledge grew in him and gave him strength. There was only one thing for it, he told himself. This nobo daddy had to be stopped, and he had to think of a way to stop him. "To be fair," said Nobo Daddy, "and in a spirit of full disclosure, I should repeat that you have already achieved something extraordinary, by crossing the line, I mean. So perhaps you are capable of further extraordinary things. Maybe you're even capable of bringing about the thing you are even now dreaming up. Maybe, ha ha, you will succeed in bringing about my destruction. An adversary. How enjoyable. How positively darling. I'm so excited." Luca looked up. "What do you mean exactly, crossing the line?" he asked. "Here, where you are, is not there where you were," explained Nobo Daddy helpfully. "This, all of this that you see, is not that which you saw before. This lane is not that lane. This house is not that house. And this daddy, as I have explained, is not that one. If the whole of your world took half a step to the right, then it would bump into this world. If it took half a step to the left, well, let's not go into that right now. Don't you see how much more brightly colored everything is here than it is back home? This, you see, I shouldn't even tell you, really. This is the world of magic." Luca remembered his stumble in the doorway and his brief but intense feeling of giddiness. Was that when he crossed the line? And had he stumbled to the right or to the left? It must have been the right, mustn't it? So this must be the right-hand path, must it not? But was that the best path for him? Shouldn't he, as a left-handed person, have stumbled to the left? He realized that he really had no idea what he was talking about. Why was he on any sort of path at all, and not just in the lane outside his house? Where might such a path lead, and should he even think of going down it? Should he be thinking about just getting away from this alarming Nobo Daddy and finding his way back to the safety of his bedroom? all this talk of magic was much too much for him. Of course, Luca knew all about the world of magic. He had grown up hearing about it from his father every day, and he had believed in it. He had even drawn maps and painted pictures of it, the torrent of words flowing into the lake of wisdom, the mountain of knowledge, the fire of life, all that stuff. But he hadn't believed in it in the way that he believed in dining tables or streets or stomach upsets. It hadn't been real in the way that love was real or unhappiness or fear. It was only real in the way that stories were real while you were reading them, or heat mirages before you got too close to them, or dreams while you were dreaming. Is this a dream, then? He wondered. And the see-through Rashid, who called himself Nobo Daddy, nodded slowly in a thoughtful way. That would certainly explain the situation, he replied agreeably. Why not put it to the test? So you'll have to find out as the book goes on whether you think it is or not. One of the things he discovers, Luca, rather rapidly about this world of magic is that it has certain interesting similarities to the world he experiences inside his various video game consoles. So that, for instance, a counter appears in the top left-hand corner of his eye, which tells him how many lives he's got, which he can collect from all over the place, you know, behind bushes and under toadstools and so on. And there's another counter in the top right-hand corner of his eyes, which tells him what level he's on, because he has to go up through a number of levels and he has to save them, otherwise he has to go back and do it again. Now, the problem, as often happens with these games, is that in order to get into the game, you have to go past a gatekeeper. I remember pathetically trying to play Tomb Raider, and I couldn't get out of the initial room, you know. I mean, that's how bad I was. So anyway, he faces this character who is the gatekeeper. He's going to try and make this journey up the river of time towards the heart of magic, which is where the fire of life is. But before he can do any of that, he's got to get past the old man of the river. And the old man of the river, unfortunately, is an evil old man with an enormous blaster called a Terminator. And at this point, Luca has been running around collecting lives, and he had collected 315 lives at this point, actually. Because of the three-digit counter in the top left of his personal screen, he guessed that the maximum number he could collect was probably 999. The old man of the river came up onto the strand with his Terminator in his hand. Luca looked around perplexedly for somewhere to hide and at the same time tried desperately to remember what his father had told him about the old man of the river, who it seemed was not just one of Rashid Khalifa's inventions after all. Or else, perhaps he was here in the world of magic because Rashid Khalifa had made him up. Luca remembered the way his father told the tale. The old man of the river has a beard like a river. It flows right down to his feet. He stands on the strand with a gun in his hand, the nastiest old man you could meet. And here indeed was that very old man with his long white river beard and his enormous blaster climbing up onto the strand. Luca did his very best to summon back the memory of what else the Shah of Bla had told him about this malevolent river demon. Something about asking the old man questions. No, riddles, that was it. Rashid loved riddles. He had tormented Luca with riddles, day after day, night after night, year after year, until Luca had become good enough to torment him back. Rashid would sit each evening in his favorite squashy armchair, and Luca would jump onto his lap, even though his mother, Soraya, scolded him, warning that the chair wasn't strong enough to take their combined weight. Luca didn't care. He wanted to sit there, and the chair had never broken, or not yet anyway. And all that riddling was about to come in handy after all. Yes, the old man of the river was a riddler. That was what Rashid had said about him. He was addicted to riddling the way gamblers were addicted to gambling or drunkards to drink. And that was how to beat him. The problem was how to get close enough to the old man to say anything at all when he had that Terminator in his hand and looked determined to shoot on sight. So he gets blasted a few times. Luca dodged from side to side, but the old man kept coming right at him. And even though first bear, the dog, and then dog, the bear tried to get in the way, a couple of blasts blew them to pieces and obliged them to wait until their bodies regrouped. And a moment later, Luca, too, had been blasted again and had to go through the whole business of flying apart into a million shiny fragments and then joining up again, making those little sucking sounds, feeling relieved that losing a life was not the same thing as dying. Then it was back to life gathering. But this time Luca made a note of the exact point where the old man came into view before he hopped up onto the strand. And he stopped collecting, positioned himself, and waited. No sooner had the old man's head come into view than Luca yelled at the top of his voice, "Riddle me, riddle me, ree," which he knew from his evenings with Rashid was the time-honored way of challenging a riddler to a battle. The old man of the river stopped in his tracks, and then a big, nasty smile spread across his face. "Who calls me?" he said in a cawing cackle of a voice. "Who thinks he can outplay the Rätselmeister, the Roi des Enigmes, the Pahelian Kapadisha, the Lord of the Riddles? Do you know what you risk? Do you understand the wager? The stakes are high, could not be higher. Look at you, you're nothing, you're a child. I don't even know if I want to face you. No, I won't face you. You are not worthy. Oh, very well, if you insist. And if you lose, child, then all your lives are mine. Do you understand? All your lives are mine. The final termination here at the beginning, you will meet your end." And this is what Luca could have said in reply, but did not, preferring to remain silent. And what you don't understand, you horrible old man, is that in the first place, it's my father who is the Riddle King, and he taught me everything he knew. What you further don't understand is that our riddle battles went on for hours and days and weeks and months and years, and so I have a supply of tough brain twisters that will never run out. And what you don't understand most of all is that I've worked out something important. Namely, that this world I'm in, this world of magic, is not just any old magical world, but the one my father created. And because this is his magic world and nobody else's, I know secrets about everything in it, including, oh terrible old man, about you. What he actually said aloud was this, "And if you lose, old man, then you will have to terminate yourself, not just temporarily, but once and for all." How the old man laughed. He guffawed until he wept, not only from his eyes, but through his nose as well. He held his sides and leapt from side to side, and his long white beard cracked in the air like a whip. "That's a good one," he said finally, panting for breath. "If I lose, that's priceless. Let's begin." But Luca wasn't going to be fooled that easily. Riddlers are tricksters, he knew that much, and you had to nail down the deal before you began the battle, or they would try to wriggle out of it later on. "If you lose, you will do as I have said," he insisted. The old man of the river made a peevish face. "Yes, yes, yes," he replied. "If I lose, I will self-terminate. Auto-terminate. Termination of me by me will occur. He, 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 I'll blast myself to bits." "Permanently," Luca said firmly. "Once and for all." The old man grew serious and his face colored unpleasantly. "Very well," he barked. "Yes, permanent termination, if I lose. In a word, permination. But as you are about to discover, child, I'm not the one who is about to lose all his lives." Bear and dog were in a state of high agitation, but now Luca and the old man were circling each other, staring each other down, and it was the old man who spoke first in a hard, greedy voice, pushing roughly through teeth that seemed hungry to eat up little Luca's life. "What goes around and around the wood, but never goes into it?" "The bark of the tree," said Luca at once, and shot back. "It stands on one leg with its heart in its head." "Cabbage," snapped the old man. "What is it that you can keep after giving it to someone else?" "Your word. I have a little house, and I live in it alone. It has no doors or windows, and to go out I must break through the wall." "Egg." "What do you call a fish without an eye?" "You call it a fish." You know. "What do sea monsters eat?" "Fish and ships." "Why was six afraid of seven?" "Because 7, 8, 9. What has been there for millions of years, but is never more than a month old?" "The moon. When you don't know what it is, then it's something, but when you know what it is, then it's nothing." "That's easy," Luca said, badly out of breath. "A riddle." They had been circling faster and faster, and the riddles had been coming at greater and greater speed. This was just the beginning, Luca knew. Soon the number riddles would start, and the story riddles. The difficult stuff still lay ahead. He wasn't sure if he could last the course. So the thing was not to let the old man dictate the pace and manner of the contest. It was time to play the joker in the pack. He stopped circling and put on his grimmest expression. What, he asked, goes on 4 legs in the morning, 2 legs at noon, and 3 legs in the evening? The old man of the river stopped circling too, and for the first time there was a weakness in his voice and a tremble in his limbs. What are you playing at? He demanded feebly. That's the most famous riddle in the world. Yes, it is, said Luca, but you're stalling for time. Answer me. 4 legs, 2 legs, 3 legs, said the old man of the river. Everyone knows this one. It's the oldest one in the book. The she-monster known as the Sphinx, Rashid Khalifa used to tell Luca, sat outside the city of Thebes and challenged all the travellers who passed by to solve her riddle. When they failed, she killed them. Then one day, a hero came by and knew the answer. And what did the Sphinx do then? Luca asked his father. She destroyed herself, Rashid replied. And what was the answer to the riddle? Luca asked. But Rashid Khalifa had to admit that no matter how many times he learned the blasted story, he could never remember the solution to the riddle. So that old Sphinx, he said, not very sadly, she'd have eaten me up for sure. Come on, Luca said to the old man of the river, your time's up. The old man of the river looked around in panic. I could just blast you anyway, he said. Luca shook his head. You know you can't do that, he said. Not now, not anymore. Then Luca allowed his expression to become a little dreamy. My father could never remember the answer either, he said. And this is my father's world of magic, and you are his riddle man. So you can't know what he couldn't recall. And now you and the Sphinx must share the same fate. Permination, the old man of the river said softly. Yes, that is just. And without more ado, and quite unsentimentally, he lifted his terminator, set the dial on maximum, pointed the weapon at himself, and fired. The answer is a man, Luca said to the empty air, as the tiny, shining smithereens of the old man blew away into nothingness, who crawls on all fours as a baby, walks upright as a grown-up, and uses a stick when he's old. That's the answer, a man. Everyone knows that. So he gets in. That's
thank you. Thanks.
Thanks. He gets in and he has various other adventures, and along the way he acquires a useful friend with a flying carpet. She's actually a queen. She's the sultana of a rather excessive, badly behaved, impolite land called Art, which stands for over the top. And she's called Saraya, like his mother, and she's the Sultana of Art, but because she's so brilliantly rude to people, she's actually known as the Insult Anna. And she has the flying carpet, which was given to her by King Solomon, so that's useful. I've always wanted a flying carpet in a novel. I finally got one. They're hard to acquire, you know. There's not many of them around. Anyway, so he's on this flying carpet with a number of his friends, and he's at this point, much later in the story, heading closer and closer to the heart of magic, as it's called, which is where the fire of life is concealed. And he comes across a rather strange land, which I thought I'd just read you a little bit about. So he looked down from the carpet, saw below him the river of time flowing from the distant, invisible lake of wisdom, which was still too far away to be seen. The river flowed into and then out of the immense circle of the circular sea, at the bottom of which he knew slept the giant worm bottom feeder, who coiled his body all the way round the circle just so that his head could nibble at its tail. Outside the circle, directly beneath the flying carpet of that moment, were the vast territories of the badly behaved gods, the gods in whom nobody believed anymore, except to stories that people once liked to tell. They don't have any power in the real world anymore, Rashid Khalifa used to say, sitting in his favorite squashy armchair with Luca curled up on his lap. So there they all are, in the heart of magic, the ancient gods of the north, the gods of Greece and Rome, the South American gods, and the gods of Sumeria and Egypt long ago. They spend their time, their infinite, timeless time, pretending they're still divine, playing all their old games, fighting their ancient wars over and over again, and trying to forget that nobody really cares about them these days or even remembers their names. That's pretty sad, Luca said to his father. To be honest with you, the heart of magic sounds a lot like an old folks' home for washed-up superheroes. don't let them hear you say that, Rashid Khalifa replied, because they all look gorgeous and youthful and luminous and, well, perfect. Being divine, or even ex-divine, has its perks. And inside the magic world, they still have the use of their superpowers. It's in the real world that their thunderbolts and enchantments no longer have any effect. Must be awful for them, Lucas said, to have been worshipped and adored for so long, and then just discarded like last year's unfashionable clothes. Particularly for the Aztec deities from Mexico, Rashid said, putting on his most scary voice, because they were used to receiving human sacrifices. The throats of living people were cut, and their lifeblood flowed into the gods' stone goblets. Now there's no blood for those disused gods to drink. You've heard of vampires? Most of them are bloodthirsty, long-in-the-tooth, undead Aztec gods. No wonder people stopped worshipping them, Luca said. Or it may be because they all behaved so badly, Rashid said. This got Luca's attention. The notion of gods behaving badly was an odd one. Weren't gods supposed to set an example to the people whose gods they were? Not in the olden days, Rashid said. These olden and now jobless gods usually behave badly as people, or actually much worse, because being gods, they could behave badly on a bigger scale. They were selfish, rude, meddlesome, vain, bitchy, violent, spiteful, lustful, gluttonous, greedy, lazy, dishonest, tricky, and stupid. And all of it exaggerated to the maximum because they had those superpowers. When they were greedy, they could swallow a city. When they were angry, they could drown the world. When they meddled in human lives, they broke hearts, stole women, and started wars. When they were lazy, they slept for 1,000 years. And when they played their little tricks, people suffered and died. Sometimes a god would even kill another god by knowing his weak spot and going for it the way a wolf goes for the throat of its prey. Maybe it's a good thing they faded away, Lucas said. But it must make the heart of magic a peculiar sort of place. Nowhere more peculiar in the universe, Rashid said. And what about the gods people still believe in? Lucas asked. Are they in the heart of magic as well? Oh, dear me, no, said Rashid Khalifa. They're all still right here with us. Let's stop there. Thanks. Thank you. So you have to guess whether there's a happy ending or not. All right. Yeah.
So I think most of you know how this works, folks. We have people with mics in the aisles. Raise your hand. I'll call on you. Please wait for the mic. We could talk about Luca. We could talk about the TSA. We could talk about Taliban, who are not. All topics are available in the second row here.
Age group do you think could get the irony and the humor?
Well, if the previous book is any guide, you know, Harun and the Sea of Stories was written in much the same way. I mean, it had readers as young as 6 or 7 and as old as 97. Actually, I know at least one 97-year-old reader of that book. So, I don't know, I think we're all children, really. You know, and I think there's a way of writing which I hope this comes close to, which allows you to stop asking the question of what's the age it's intended for, you know, and it's just for anybody who enjoys it, really. And I think, you know, the movies do this very well. I think if you, there's a whole range of movies now, you know, Pixar movies, Star Wars, Avatar, all these films, you know, you don't ask yourself whether they're for children or grown-ups. Obviously, people go to them and get different satisfactions, and I hope that would happen with this. I mean, I remember, for instance, many years ago, when Who Framed Roger Rabbit came out, I remember going to see it and being annoyed by the fact that the children in the audience were laughing so much, making so much noise, that I couldn't hear the really very clever dialogue. And so I went to see it again in a late night performance when all the nasty children were out of the way. So I could hear the words. And I think, you know, it showed me that there is a way of placing a story on this, what I think is an increasingly interesting boundary between childhood and adulthood. And if you do it right, when people can come at it from different directions, you know, and get their own satisfactions. So, I mean, I think Alice in Wonderland is a book like that. You know, an adult can read that and see many, many things in it amongst all the nonsense, you know, which are very grown up. I mean, to be asked the difference between saying what you mean and meaning what you say is a profound question, you know. When Humpty Dumpty says, when I use a word, it means what I want it to mean, neither more nor less, he could be any politician, really. And so, obviously, Lewis Carroll, who was a philosopher, who was a mathematician, etc., you know, put in his story all kinds of little nuggets which grown-ups would find and children would just enjoy the nonsense. You know, so, and I hope this works. I mean, I don't wish to compare myself to a hero of mine, but if it comes anywhere close to Lewis Carroll, I'd be very happy.
Another question.
At the back there?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. We'll go all the way in the back and then over here. Well, if you could please wait for the mic, it'll be there momentarily.
Well, there's people in other rooms.
So as someone who teaches Midnight's Children quite frequently, and I have people here who have studied it with me, I'm wondering whether the reverse is true when you talk about the relationship between magic and reality. It's there in all your books for adults. And I wonder if you could just speak about the process of conceiving that relationship differently for children as for adults.
It's not as different as you would think is the answer. I suppose there have been, writing these two books, Harun and Luca, there were sort of moments when I would cut a sentence in half, you know, have two shorter sentences instead of one long one. And there would be some moments when I would choose a simpler word rather than a more complicated word. But actually, children like complicated words. You know, they like having words they don't understand in a text, and it makes them feel grown up, you know, not knowing that grown-ups actually like simple words. I think it was Philip Pullman, it may not have been, who said that you don't write down to children, you write up. You know, that children are a very, very demanding audience. They tend not to finish books they don't like. In fact, they usually follow the advice of Dorothy Parker, who, when she didn't like a book, said this book should not be put down, it should be hurled across the room with great force. And if you don't want to see your book, you know, flying across through the air, you'd better make it good. You know, so in that sense, it's just as demanding. It's just as demanding to write for children as for grown-ups. I mean, I suppose one of the main differences in these two books was that I had particular readers in mind. I mean, normally you don't. Normally you write a book and your sense of the reader is very indistinct. And you often think, in fact, that the reader is yourself looking over your shoulder because it's difficult to second guess what the general public will think about any given story. But in these books, I did very much have my own sons in mind, and the characters of Harun in the first book and Luca in this book were quite deliberately modeled on the boys that I knew who were to be the first readers of the books. And that's a big difference. I mean, that's not normally how one approaches characterization, or at least I don't, to deliberately try to model a character on a real person. And then, of course, you've got to please them, which is tough, as I say. And they were both quite critical readers. I've always remembered with the first book, with Harun and the Sea of Stories, when I'd written a few chapters, I was a bit worried about the tone of voice and whether it was working or not. And I gave my older son, Zafar, whose middle name is Harun, the first few chapters to read. And he read them. And I said, well, what do you think? And he said, no, I like them, Dad. He said, you know, some people might be bored. He said, you know, not me, of course, I'd read it, but, you know, some people. And I said, well, what do you mean bored? And he used this wonderful phrase. He said, it doesn't have enough jump in it. I said, jump? Well, I knew exactly what he meant. I said, I can do jump. I said, you know, give me that back, you know. And I went away and I rewrote it and gave it back to him, and now through gritted teeth said, so what's it like now? And he said, no, now it's fine. You know? And it was sort of the best constructive criticism I ever received from any editor. You know? So, in this book, I was worried about the passage I read, The Character of Nobodaddy. Oh, by the way, I should say that the name Nobo Daddy is not my invention. It's actually invented by William Blake. There's a poem of William Blake's called To Nobo Daddy. Nobo Daddy is God for William Blake. It's the absent father. It's the father who never tells you, who's never there, he never says anything, he never does anything. What kind of father is he anyway? And there's this poem that Blake wrote as a kind of complaint against God for not being there and being no help, you know, being a kind of nobody of a father. So of course, in this book, he's more death than God, but I just had to give credit to Blake for coming up with the word. But I worried that this figure might be too frightening, because, I mean, we know that children like the bad guy, and they like, you know, they like frightening characters, hence the relative popularity of Darth Vader and the relative unpopularity of Luke Skywalker, you know? I mean, I don't think there's any kids wandering around Philadelphia tonight saying, I'm Luke Skywalker, you know? There might be one or two pretending to be Han Solo, but there would be a lot wanting the helmet and the weird breathing. So children know that there's a kind of delight to be found in the bad guy. And so that's not what I was worried about. I was just worried that if you go over a certain edge, then it stops being a kind of pleasurable fear, and it can become a disturbing fear. And given that we're talking here about the death of a father, and I'm writing the book for my son, I wondered whether that was going just over the edge, you know. So I gave him the first couple of chapters to read, and again, I didn't say anything. I just said, just read them. And then I went away and, you know, kept my fingers crossed, because I thought, if he doesn't like it, then I'm kind of screwed, because I have to rethink the whole book. And fortunately, he didn't have a problem with it. And in fact, without prompting, said to me that it was his favorite character, which gave, first of all, it gave me permission to sort of just go for it, you know, without worrying. But also it made me think that this kid maybe has a little darkness in him, you know, and maybe I could just push it a bit further, you know. So that was helpful too. So, yeah, I mean, they were both very, very good readers of the book, and read it before anyone else did. They had to tick, you know, I had to get the tick at the bottom of the manuscript before publishers or anyone else was allowed to read it.
About eight rows back, right in the center. Take one, then the other.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you here this evening.
Hi.
You just used the phrase, rethink the whole book. So my question for you is, would you kindly elaborate on your process of writing? When you approach a new project, do you have only a germinal, you know, seed idea in mind? Mm. Do you approach it with an outline? Does the book grow organically?
Yeah.
Would you kindly tell us something about what happens in your workroom?
Well,
thank you.
Well, the truth is that all of that happens, because no two books arrive in quite the same way. You know, I mean, there have been books like Harun and the Sea of Stories, where the narrative line arrived almost fully formulated right away, you know, and the difficulty of that book was finding the tone of voice and the language for it, which would allow it to sit on what we've been talking about, on this frontier between childhood and adulthood, you know. And that I had a lot of trial and error when I thought it was too grown up or too childish or whatever, to try and find that note to hit was the problem of that book. But in that case, I had the storyline very early. In this case, it was sort of the opposite. In this case, I knew how to write it because I'd done it before. You know, and I thought I just have to use the same kind of language and tone of voice as I used before, and that I know it works. You know? So, and this time, what took me all the time was actually working out the story and seeing exactly how the different stages of the quest, you know, would go, to make them individually interesting, but also to hold together, you know, formally, etc. So it was the opposite thing. I mean, there have been books, for instance, when I wrote Shalimar the Clown, I initially just had an image of three characters. I had a scene in my head, which was a murder scene, you know, in which there's I just had this image of a man standing over another man who was dead on the floor. And I knew that this was happening outside the house in which the dead man's daughter lived. For some reason, I had this scene, and I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know who they were, you know, and I had to find out who they were. And in the end, realized that there was a fourth character not in the scene who was the wife of the murderer, the lover of the dead man, and the mother of the illegitimate girl behind the door. and that somehow she was the explanation of this thing. So it became a novel about four people. And really, I just had these four characters very firmly in my head rather than a form or an exact way of proceeding. And in that book, I did what I thought of as listening. You know, I would sit down every day and just try and listen to the characters and see what they needed today. You know, and gradually they helped me to unfold the story. You know, so that happened. Midnight's Children, for instance, came about in a very odd way. I mean, you know, initially I had thought of it in a much smaller scale way. You know, I had thought that I wanted to write a novel about childhood, and would obviously use the material of my childhood growing up in Bombay. And of course, that was an interesting moment to grow up in Bombay because it was immediately after the independence of India. And so it was an interesting generation because it's a generation of transition. You know, as we all know about decolonization, it doesn't end on the day the colonial power leaves. You know, and the influence of that power is still very much there. For, you know, like now, if you go to India, the British influence has rather faded. And actually, there's more American influence than British. And in the way that people would think that you would send your children to Oxford and Cambridge, you know, now they want to send them to Stanford and MIT, and, you know, so on. So it's different now. But in that generation, I felt that, you know, the old was there and the new was being born, you know, and it made it interesting to write. And I thought it was just that. I wanted to write about childhood at that time. And then at a certain moment, you know, I'm 8 weeks older than the hero of Midnight's Children. And I was born 2 months before the partition of India, the independence of India. And my father used to tell this joke that wasn't even very funny at the time, actually, about how I got born and 8 weeks later the British ran away. You know? and I thought, you know, the first time I heard it, it wasn't that funny. And, you know, the 401st time I heard it, it really, really wasn't funny at all. But at a certain point, I guess I should be grateful because it gave me the idea that there actually doesn't have to be that eight-week gap. You know, supposing you close the gap. Supposing you have a child that's born at the exact time that the British ran away. And what would that, at that point, I suddenly realized that I'd had an idea that was possibly a good idea, but it made the whole book much more complicated to write. You know, because history rushes into the book at that point. At that point, if you are saying that the child you're writing about and the country that he's born into are born at the same time, you know, that they're sort of twins, then you have to tell the story of both the twins. You know, and so you have to tell the story of the country as well as the boy. And it became a much larger canvas at that point and terrified me. You know, it was a scary book to try and write because it felt impossible to write, actually. It took me 5.5 years, you know. So as I say, you can come at it, sometimes it's structural, sometimes it's an individual character. It can, you know, I wish it always did come in the same way because I'd write more books, you know. But instead I have to wait for something to grab me, you know. I mean, one thing I will say is that usually it's very unusual for me to think of a book and sit down and write it. You know, it's usual that these ideas are in my head for very long periods of time. And the fact that they stay in my head for long periods of time is, in the end, what makes me pay attention to them. You know, and I think, why is it in my head all this? Why am I still thinking about that? You know, and then I pay attention to it. You know, so quite often these ideas have been sometimes 10 years, 15 years in my head. You know, when I wrote The Enchantress of Florence, that was 20 years after I thought about it. You know, and in some ways even longer than that, because I'd studied both Mughal history and medieval and Renaissance history at university. I mean, I studied history at university, not English. So I had been interested in a lot of this stuff, the character of Machiavelli and so on, you know, since I was 20 years old. And it sat in my head for a really long time before I found the book. So I'm like that. I'm a mess.
Okay, just behind you, Lindsay, fellow with his hand up.
You discussed before about the movies and the line between adult and children's movies and literature as well. I sort of had a question that's related to that. Like, as you were reading your book, two things came to mind, the movie Inception and the Harry Potter series.
Yeah.
So as a consumer of this type of media, which has been coming at me basically since I was born, I want to know from your perspective, what makes you and, I guess, your contemporaries of film directors, other authors, write about these types of themes of the lines between magic and real? And I think it's something newer that maybe my parents didn't necessarily grow up with.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question, really, because there's no doubt that, to put it to say broadly, fantasy fiction used to be the poor relation of literature. You know, it used to be the kind of ignorant country cousin that people would look down on. And that's changed. That's changed in art. And I think a lot of the change is due to the cinema. A lot of the change is due to the arrival of technology in filmmaking, which makes it possible to make films about things that don't exist and make them look as if they do. I mean, I've always remembered, you know, the famous first shot of the movie, which used to be called Star Wars, you know, which we now have to call A New Hope, which is a really, really bad title. Whereas Star Wars, of course, is a great title. But there's this first shot after you have the roller title about, you know, the galaxy far, far away. Interestingly about Star Wars, that as it tells us at the beginning, it's not about the future, it's about the past. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So here's this extremely futuristic sequence of films which tells you that it's about yesterday, not tomorrow. But there's this shot that with which the film begins of this giant rocket ship, spaceship coming over your head like that, you know. And it comes over your head into shot, and it keeps going and going and going and going, and it gets longer and bigger, and you can't believe how huge it is, you know. And at that point, you realize that something had happened to the movies, that you could actually create an intergalactic spaceship and make it look like it was an airplane flying in the sky. And everything changed, I think. Because until then, science fiction movies had been very cheap B-movies in which the furniture shook, you know. When the alien came out of the spaceship and shut the door of the spaceship kind of trembled. You know? and you know, the monster from the Black Lagoon and the Blob and all these people, well, they were very primitive creatures. But I think that changed, and you're right, there was a whole generation that began to think of this kind of fantasy film as being at the center of cinema rather than at the fringes. I'm not sure it's entirely a good thing, because I grew up in a different age of the cinema in which world cinema really was having an extraordinary moment, you know, and it's very hard now to tell people what it felt like when the great films, which are now the classics of the cinema, were that week's new movies. You know, when you went to the movies and that week the new movie was La Dolce Vita. You know, and the next week it was the new Godard movie, and then the new Kurosawa samurai movie, and then the new Ingmar Bergman movie, and then, you know, so on and so on and so on. I mean, the extraordinary excitement of the world cinema in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, is something which it's gone now. And what we have instead is this kind of fantasy stuff. And I mean, I don't do it always, you know. I mean, I think in these two books, I thought that it was the way to write this book, which lived on this in this area, which broadly speaking you could call fable, you know, and the fable or folk tale or fairy tale has always been the way of speaking to all generations, and that's what made me want to put it there. But I mean, you know, Shalimar the Clown, I was talking about. I mean, that's a very largely naturalistic novel because it needed to be. The story demanded it. So I don't do it always. And I think this term, you know, I get used, the term magic realism gets used about my work a lot. And I worry about it a bit because I think when people use the phrase, what they hear is magic and they don't hear realism. And I think even when you talk about those great Latin American writers about whom the term, you know, was properly used, Garcia Marquez and this year's Nobel laureate Vargas Llosa and so on, their purposes were real. They weren't trying to escape from reality. They were trying to find other languages to describe reality. And I think the term is best used about them because actually that kind of writing has been in literature for as long as you can think. I mean, I guess, you know, Kafka's Metamorphosis, you know, you could call a work of magic realism. Gogol, you know, the nose of the overcoat, you could call a work of magic realism. French surrealism is really the same thing. In the United States in the 70s, the fabulist movement with writers like Thomas Pynchon and Robert Coover and John Barth, that was really the same thing as well. So this spirit of non-naturalistic techniques used to approach human truth has been there throughout literature. You know? And in my case, I mean, I got a lot of it from things like the Arabian Nights and so on. I mean, it was a lot of my formative reading as a child. So it's a way of doing it, is what I'm saying. It's not the only way of doing it. It may not be the best way of doing it, but it's one of the ways of doing it. You know, and I was talking to a bunch of school kids yesterday and today in New York and here. And if you use the example, for example, if you go to the Museum of Modern Art and you look at Van Gogh's portrait of a starry night, it's an extraordinary picture, but it doesn't look like a starry night. I mean, if you ever go out in the sky and look at a starry night, it doesn't look like that. And if you take a photograph of a starry night, that's not what comes out on the photograph. And yet, it's an amazing picture of a starry night. And it captures an enormous amount of the power and the emotion of such a night. And I guess that's what I'm saying, that in the way that an expressionist oil painting can be different from a photograph, this kind of writing, which is not naturalistic, can be different from reportage, from realism, from... But they're just different ways of skinning the same cat, you know, and the question is whether you do it well or badly.
We have to leave it on a very starry night. Thank you for coming. Please join me in thanking Salman Rushdie. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.